It was Benjamin Franklin who, more than 200 years ago, famously opined that in this world, nothing is certain but death and taxes. These days, it seems a growing number of lawmakers have embraced a slightly different version of Franklin's adage. A vote for a tax increase, they say, or at least believe, means certain death at the ballot box. In an era of no new tax pledges and public outrage over what critics construe as wasteful government spending, will the General Assembly ever again be able to pass legislation that isn't, in the vernacular of the State House, revenue neutral? Hi, I'm John Schwanes, and we'll seek answers to that tax question and many others on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers. From the State House to your house.
Purdue Research Park. Four locations, 200 companies, 4,000 jobs. Purdue Research Park. The idea economy is here.
The General Assembly's 2012 session isn't a budget session, though the average observer might have drawn a different conclusion based on the number and variety of tax-related conversations that have taken place at the State House in recent months. The proposed phase-out of the state's inheritance tax, the prospect of an internet sales tax, the push to boost income tax and property tax revenue through local referenda, and the promise of automatic tax refunds tied to state budget surpluses. All of those things have been on the agenda to some extent this session. So what, if any, tax changes can we expect in the remaining weeks of the 2012 session? And how about next session, when lawmakers will be crafting a two-year state budget? Here to discuss the issue are Republican Representative Jeff Espick of Uniondale, Chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee and the State Budget Committee, Republican Senator Luke Kinley of Noblesville, Chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee and a member of the Senate Tax and Fiscal Policy Committee and the State Budget Committee, Democratic Representative Scott Pilath of Michigan City, Assistant House Democratic Leader and a member of the House Ways and Means Committee, and John Ketzenberger, President of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute, an independent nonprofit research organization devoted to studying the impact of state taxing and spending policies, and of course my longtime colleague on the Public Affairs Program, Indiana Week in Review. We need to get you on the Ways and Means Committee. Apparently that's a requirement being on the show.
I'm the odd man out here.
Well, there's nothing more important, arguably, than dollars and cents when it comes to a legislative session, even a non-budgetary session. So I appreciate your being here for this discussion, all of you. Jeff Espick, 40 years in the General Assembly. You've been in there, first elected in 1972.
72.
And we should point out that you're not, you announced recently that you would not be seeking another term.
Right.
So first let me say, I know I speak for many, when
thank you for your
service.
Thanks, John.
And you're a lawmaker who, I'm sure Scott Pilath will agree, is someone who enjoys respect of many people on both sides of
most
the
of
aisle.
Us. Most of us do, John, seriously, mm-hmm. But thank you.
So those are all the nice things. So they
okay.
got those out of the
all
way.
Right. All right.
Good. You've seen an evolution in public views toward taxation, I would guess. What have you seen? I mean, now the dreaded T word sort of can be a real death knell for many politicians. I don't guess necessarily it was quite that dramatic back in the 70s and 80s.
Probably not, but the property tax has been hated, for instance, for as long as I've been here, 40 years at least. In fact, Otis Bowen ran on property tax relief. That he was governor elected in 72, and so getting rid of the property tax or lowering it has been an age-old quest. And frankly, we've done a pretty good job. I mean, it's under control today. People won't think that when they get their bills, but we've done a marvelous job in moving away from property tax.
I thought the auto excise tax was the most hated tax.
That was
back in the 80s.
But, you know, we kind of took care of that one 20 years ago. We cut it in half. It's remained, you know, much less onerous than it once was. So, yeah, it's better.
All right, let me get your take. You've been there basically half as long as he has.
He's a newcomer. I
arrived at the State House as a reporter after he got there, but a little bit before you got there. So, I mean, do you agree that there has been something of an evolution?
You know, I think the biggest change, I know that there's an attitude of we don't like taxes, because if you look at the growth of the country at all levels of government, it feels like you're always wanting a little more government, a different service. And so there's been not a lot of times where you've said, let's go the other way on these things. But I think one of the most challenging elements of it is, what is a fair taxing system? And with the change in our society, with the mobility that people have, some of the old taxes like the income tax, the inheritance tax, things that were based on where you lived, people are now saying, well, let's go ahead and move to Florida where it's nice and they don't have an income tax, they don't have an inheritance tax, so let's get out of here. So and they're hard to collect because people are self-reporting on a lot of these things. So the consumption tax is beginning to be the one that's the most reliable in our modern technological society, and it's changing how we look at taxes.
But does everyone appreciate the nuance there? It seems that for some people it's simply a matter of if it's a tax or a fee increase masquerading as a tax in their eyes, bad. Doesn't matter even if there perhaps is some sort of offset that may in fact make it revenue neutral.
Well, I think people demand a justification for the tax more carefully than they used to. They've seen it tried in every different way, whether it's a fee or a user fee or what, however you phrase it, they see it as a tax. So they are much more dynamic about saying, don't do this to me unless you can really justify this.
And do you think, Scott Pilath, that it's the General Assembly necessarily is not being as careful with people's dollars, or let's say any government, federal level, let's say Congress or any state agency or state legislative body, or is it that the critics, and let's point to one of the most obvious, Grover Norquist and Americans for Tax Reform, which came around in 1986, seems to hold sway with a lot of people in our state house as well as state houses across the country.
It's funny you said the word or the number 1986 because, Luke, when I was a 16-year-old, high school student, Michigan
City
Elston High School,
good, huh?
And Jeff had been in the General Assembly for 14 years already. Bob Orr, great Republican governor of Indiana, pushed the largest general tax increase in state history, the A-plus plan, in order to fund public education. How far we've come. Neither party likes taxes, and both parties recognize that whatever tax you eliminate or cut, there's always going to be a new most hated tax. But there's things we have to do as a society. There's services and good things that government can do that people demand. And we always have to be prepared, if the people call for it, to be in a position to raise the revenues that are necessary to fulfill those aims. It does worry me that some have now become so strident in their views. And because of, thanks for the softball with Grover Norquist, people lock themselves in to a pattern of decision making that makes it very difficult to maneuver. I hope that some of that's going to subside over time. We always want to look for ways to reduce taxes. We have different ideas about how to do that. Respectfully, I would say that over the past few years in tax policy, we've targeted tax cuts more towards the investor side, forgotten about the consumer and worker side. I think we need to have a better balance there.
But I know you said after last year's budget, for instance, I think you called it one of the meanest because of what you viewed as favoring corporate tax cuts.
Well, I stand by that. I do think certain elements of that are mean. I don't lay that all at the feet of the two gentlemen that are sitting right here. I think a lot of it came down from on the second floor. But we can't be the types of lawmakers that are going to be so dogmatic that we will never consider anything under any circumstances. I think that's bad for the republic.
John Katzenberger, you study these issues. This is a facetious question, but maybe not entirely facetious. Who has more clout in Indiana, Grover Norquist or Mitch Daniels?
I won't answer that question. But I will say that I think that the effect of Grover Norquist on the process has been a problem for policymakers, but also for taxpayers, because we don't have as honest and open discussion about taxes as we used to. You know, you talk about when Jeff entered the legislature in 1972, it was all about property taxes. That was the Bowen era when we put the caps on many areas of property taxes, and it's been an eternal question. What has changed is that all taxes are bad. And I think that the conversation has moved from what do we get for our taxes to how can we reduce the tax first and foremost. And I think people forget that you pay for the government services through your taxes. You know, you have police and fire protection. You have government services. You have things that are provided to you so that you have a civil society. We need to have a discussion about what do we get for our taxes rather than how can we reduce them. And then I think you have a more healthy discussion, you have a better informed electorate, and a better policy discussion.
John, don't you think that people do that because inside themselves, even if they don't know they're saying this, that I'm not getting value received?
I think that is true. I think that the state or the federal government needs to make a better case for everything that it does, because it is taking that money out of your pocket, and that money should be spent well. So it's a universal discussion that I think is stymied right now because of the anti-tax notion first.
Well, it's interesting you'd mention this notion of citizens wondering if they're getting the bang for their buck, and there were opportunities, I guess you could say, on a couple of bills to sample that through referenda. And this is not going to be the Grover Norquist show, but some people would say that Grover Norquist and his reminders about those who had signed tax pledges helped derail, for instance, the referenda that Hamilton County residents, Marion County residents, many of your constituents, Luke Kinley, would have engaged in to say either we do or don't want to pay 0.3% more in income tax to fund a $1.3 billion mass transit program. Now, I know conventional wisdom might be also a guy got tied up in your committee, incidentally. That's why I'm going to bring this question to you.
Took care of that one, didn't we?
In right to work. But was it really right to work, or was it this was all about concerns about taxes? And if it was, why not, if you're saying people should know what the value is that they're getting for their tax buck, why not let people decide that?
Well, first of all, I shouldn't say this, but since I'm leaving the legislature anyway, not running again, I can. I don't think we're overtaxed as Hoosiers, period. Now, there may be exceptions to that rule, but there may be some inequities in how we tax, as Scott might say, but we're not overtaxed. And frankly, even under Democrat administrations, pretty frugally run, well-run government, our state tax system, at least for certain.
Well, you are leading, aren't you?
Well, but
are you going to finish the next week and a half or two, or are you just walking out of the studio and into the sunset here?
Somebody asked. I told one of my friends the other day. I said, one of my legislative buddies. I said, I'm having a bad day, and he says, you feeling bad because you're leaving? I said, that was yesterday. Today, I'm feeling bad because I'm still here. in all seriousness, I don't think we're overtaxed as Hoosiers, either at the state or the local level, and. Our governments run pretty efficiently. That doesn't mean we don't have to be careful. We don't, you know, not to raise taxes, but we're doing okay, actually.
Well, how about the referenda?
No, the referenda.
I'm curious about that. Because
you know, we got into the referenda because of the property tax issue, and we had a heated debate in my committee as to whether we really wanted to give people referendums on these, for example, school buildings or municipal buildings. And most of us felt that it was the obligation of the elected leadership to be ahead of the people and understand where the people needed to go and to make those decisions for them, taking into account all of your other budgetary obligations. But in that case, we thought that people had lost so much confidence in the process because they saw these Taj Mahal school buildings and they weren't sure about it, that we needed to test that referendum idea with them. I think that this is kind of phase two. When Jeff had the question, should we raise mass transit fees by a referendum vote? And I personally think that that's problematic because in that case, you're dealing with a long-term commitment when you have other budget commitments, and it's very hard to ask the general populace to totally understand how many jails they're going to have to build and all these other things they're going to have to do. So I think there's a resistance to referendums in Indiana, and I think it'll be questionable as to whether it goes much farther than it has.
Yeah, let me throw in on this, John. The referendum for schools and school buildings wasn't meant to give the people the ability to build buildings. It was meant to give people a say in whether we don't build buildings. Before, for instance, a school board could make the decision on its own, we're going to build a Taj Mahal. Now the referendum comes along and says, wait a second, the public's got to agree to that. You have to get the public's approval to do that. So although we do have some referendum for schools to allow them to spend money, the majority of our referendums in Indiana have been to empower the people to say no, not to say yes.
So, but we do have the school referenda, and in fact, the administration, Republican administration, and a legislative agenda spearheaded by Becky Skillman, Lieutenant Governor, wanted to give that same ability, that same flexibility to counties and city governments that may be strapped. And obviously that didn't go anywhere. So there, I mean, I'm asking you, Scott, if you have lawmakers who say that we should be ahead of voter sentiment, it's our job to make the tough calls, but then because of Grover Norquist,
right,
and we mention him again, they're not willing to make the tough calls, where does it all end up?
Well, here's to do great things, it still takes leaders with vision, and leaders with a vision who can then go articulate those things to the greater public and move our state and our country in the direction that needs to go. You know, referenda makes sense in certain circumstances, but if you live by the referendum, you die by the referendum. And the point is, it's a decision-making tool like anything else. It's up to us to decide when to employ that tool. But I will have to say that if you continually turn very tough decisions over the referendum, it's very easy to wind up with paralysis. And let's just look at the state of California as a perfect example. They're willing to slap anything on the ballot in order to make a decision. And what you have ultimately is a very weak government that can't decide anything, and a state that most would agree isn't governed very well.
We could talk about this. Let's jump into some of the specific proposals, or we're going to run out of time.
Okay.
Unless you do want to, and I'll let you finish up on that point.
Okay, on the referendum point?
Yeah, go ahead.
Finish on the referendum point.
Then we're going to get into internet sales taxes, so
okay.
You're cutting into your own time on that.
All right, so briefly, I think that we are at a period of understanding how referenda work. I mean, it's still a relatively new process in Indiana, and it'll be interesting to see how the legislature allows referenda to advance. We've gotten so far. The critics will say, if you've gone this far, then you might as well go all the way. But I think Scott makes a very good point about if you do go all the way, then you've divested power from the state house, and you go in all kinds of directions that I don't think you really want to go, because we're talking about complex financial transactions when you're talking about funding for buildings, schools, whatever. So I think that it'll be interesting to see how over the next several years that evolves going forward.
And some of these things, as you say, are not necessarily crystal clear. I know your organization put together an analysis, for instance, and this is where I'm going to get to the internet.
Nice transition.
Thank you, sales tax. And I mean, you got these number crunching, and the range is, well, it's maybe 77 million, but give or take 37 million. It could
right.
be as low as, what, 14 or 40, and all the way up to
right.
hundreds. So, I mean, there are some, this is not an exact science, but your organization, as it relates to internet sales tax or the lack thereof, sees that as a revenue gap that I know you don't take policies that necessarily should be solved, should be plugged, but it is a gap.
Well, first of all, this is money that's already owed the state. People who buy goods over the internet or through the mail are obligated to pay that sales tax. What our study showed was that an awful lot of people in Indiana don't pay that tax.
1 out of 100, John.
1 out of 100. That's exactly right.
1 out of 100 people 1%. Who are supposed to pay do.
That's right. There are 3 million tax returns filed in Indiana. 3,000 have any use tax on them. So what we set out to find out was how much is the state losing through this process. And you're right, it's an inexact number. But we took all of the numbers that have been presented before, reconciled them with the national study by the University of Tennessee, and came up with what we think is the best estimate for how much the state's losing, right at $77 million, give or take that large amount. That's a lot of money. Now, when you put it against the $14 billion that the state collects over 2 years or every year for other taxes and everything, it's a small percentage. But it's a lot of money. And it's an important policy discussion and decision, too. So we thought it was important to get that information out so that the policy discussion could be informed from, we think, a statistically defensible position.
And now Amazon, which, of course, is the big player on the e-commerce block and has four distribution facilities here in the state of Indiana. They currently don't collect sales tax. And I think your numbers showed that their share of that somewhere between here and here number might be around 20-25
That's right.
million. Now there's a deal that the administration struck that says by January 1st of 2014, you'll start paying it voluntarily. You got a lot of people, retailers around the state, bricks and mortar retailers saying, what's wrong? Why can't we do it now? Virginia just got a deal they announced last week where it's going to be September of 2013. How come Indiana was at the table first but is going to get the scraps?
Well, first of all, Indiana has a better deal than most states right now. There's only about 6 states in the nation that are actually enjoying the benefits of Amazon collecting tax for them. And we actually became the 7th following Tennessee.
Right.
Now, it may be, in fact, that Virginia has just adopted a little bit better deal than we had, and maybe we can get there in another year. Maybe they can decide to up their date of collection a little bit. But frankly, we've already got one of the best deals in the nation. And as you said, John, Amazon is somewhere between 5% and 15% of the problem. Everybody else is the problem also. All the overstock.com and eBay, lots of them out there who haven't even come to the table and said, let us collect for you. These are the bad guys. Amazon, we can hate Amazon like we used to hate the New York Yankees when they were the best in the world.
Used to?
When you were a kid. Well,
he is getting soft in his
head. No, but I mean, they're the recognized villain, but the reality is, They are, at least have said they'll collect for us, and most have not.
And Amazon is fighting in Congress for this to be applied even-handedly across the nation.
And you've been involved in that, in fact.
Yeah, you talk about courage. The feds are the ones that's got to fix it. All they got to do is pass a law at the federal government and say you all collect, and they will.
Well, that's what Amazon wants. Luke Kenley, that's what you've been pushing for. You testified, if I'm not mistaken, on Capitol Hill on that. But that's may or may not happen, I guess, is anybody's guess.
Well, that will eventually come about through one means or another. Either the feds will pass it or the states, because they'll have to protect the integrity of their sales tax system. They can't afford to continue to abuse their local bricks and mortar retailers who are providing jobs, paying taxes, and doing all these other things at a 7% disadvantage in this state. So the state will find a way to get there eventually.
Go ahead, Scott Peeling.
Well, one thing I wanted to say about the sales tax, you know, we were talking about the most hated taxes before. Sales tax, honestly, is one of the least hated taxes because people perceive that they have a choice in whether they pay it or not. Now, the way it has to be applied, though, there's three rules. It has to be broad, it has to be fair, it has to be collectible. And I think it's been a good revenue stream for the state. I think we do have some matters we need to correct, and we're working on those. But there's one thing threatens that. And that's gasoline prices. Mm-hmm. Gasoline prices is an ogre on the horizon right here. Any economist will tell you that things are looking a little brighter nationally. Some of the leading economic indicators are in the right direction, but fuel prices threaten to choke off that recovery.
Well, and you and members of your party have called for.
And the state has only one arrow in the quiver when it comes to fuel prices, and that is the collection of sales tax on our fuel.
So we're going to be hearing, basically, I know what we're going to be hearing about that, if, in fact, we get the $5 gallon
gas. That's one reason we need to solve these collection problems, because it then empowers us to make those tough decisions narrowly on things like fuel prices, where we may be able to do some good as a state.
All right, we're out of time, but we'll end with the inheritance tax, which I guess you could say is the end in and of itself. 10-year phase out, looks as if it's going to happen with higher exemptions in the immediate future. Is that a plan that's going to satisfy?
I think you'll see something, and there will be the intent to permanently eliminate it. Our ability to do so depends on how much of that cost we can absorb within our budget needs going forward.
Sounds like another report that the Fiscal Policy Institute needs to do.
we'll get on it.
Working on that? All right. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I wish we had more. Again, my guests have been Republican Representative Jeff Espick of Uniondale, Republican Senator Luke Kenley of Noblesville, Democratic Representative Scott Peelath of Michigan City, and John Ketzenberger, President of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. The short session is in the home stretch. What made it to the finish and what never got out of the gate? The four caucus leaders are back on the next Indiana Lawmakers. And time now for our weekly conversation with Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter, Indiana Legislative Insight. Well, that was a roundtable. I learned a few things from interesting take on public policy as it relates to taxation. What stuck out for you?
I think just the roadmap that, in particular, Senator Kenley offered for the future, the kinds of issues that the next governor is going to have to deal with, that legislatures of the future are going to have to deal with, because we are a changed society in how we look at what we tax and how we tax it.
But even with that changed roadmap, you're still, to continue the metaphor, going to be a lot of barriers, potential potholes, if in fact we see the no new tax forces continue to hold sway to the extent that they have in the past.
Sure, but you have to also face reality at times, and one of those things Representative Peelath, I think, was just starting to get to it as the roundtable ended, is the gas tax itself. And we're looking at a changed society where, you know, because of the high price of gas, because of more fuel-efficient vehicles, because of the change to ethanol and things like that and electric vehicles, we're simply going to be having spending less money at the pumps. And that means less money coming in from the gas tax to fill those potholes. So we're going to have to look at alternatives to those kinds of things just based on the way that society is changing.
So those discussions we can look forward to in 2013.
In the meantime, here, where's my automatic taxpayer refund?
What's going to happen here in the next week and a half? Or will any of the tax measures of substance evolve in a manner different from what is expected at this point?
Probably not, but I think the one to keep an eye on is one that has some tax implications, that has some major economic implications down the road, and that's that synthetic natural gas plant in Rockport that we authorized a few years ago, that the state's committed to buy all the output from over the objections of some of the major utilities. The House Committee on Ways and Means, which Representative Espich chairs, passed an amendment last week that essentially rescinds a big tax credit that was necessary for that plant. There's going to be a huge fight between the governor and the legislature kind of behind the scenes in the next 10 days over that, and consumers are the ones that are going to be having to watch the bottom line on that.
And proving that a shared party affiliation doesn't necessarily guarantee that individuals will be in lockstep on an issue. I mean, where do we end up with this? What's the smart money bet?
I think you're going to see some real questions raised about what it means for consumers, what it means for Indiana Coal, and I don't know where this is going to go. We don't know how far the governor is going to push on this and how far the legislature may push back.
All right, Ed. Thanks, as always, for your insight. Appreciate it.
For more information, episode streams, and extra content, visit us on the web at WFYI.org/lawmakers. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And you can access live streaming coverage of the General Assembly on the Internet as well. And remember, you can get our show on demand from both Xfinity and Bright House Networks. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwannis. We're back again next week. Until then, take care.
The idea economy is here at the Purdue Research Park. A powerful economic engine and a technology conduit from Chicago to Louisville. Purdue Research Park, the idea economy is here.